Welcome to episode 170 of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast for November 7th, 2010. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. In this week's episode of the Fredcast, it appears in Vail, Colorado, a cyclist's life really ain't worth that much. Plus, Long Beach, California has a critical mass showdown, a product recall. Feeling sick? Get on your bike. Some pro cycling news, an inspirational story of cyclists raising money for their own road repairs, and a judge saying a four-year-old can be sued in a bike crash. Plus, pod-safe cycling music and a whole lot more. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Fellow Freds, welcome back to another episode of the Fredcast. And speaking of another episode, are you aware that we've gone to a much more regular schedule with the Spokesman Cycling Roundtable podcast? If you haven't heard it, go check it out. It's at www.the-spokesman.com. And we just did another show yesterday, hour and a half long, so be prepared. But I think it is a really great show. Hey, this week's episode of the Fredcast is brought to you by the folks at Jensen USA, at Epic Planet, and of course by listeners like you. And we will talk about those last two a little bit later in the show. But first, I'd like to take this opportunity to mention our friends at Jensen USA. Jensen USA has another great special for you this week. It's a tire clearance from WTB or Wilderness Trail Bikes. They've got 14 tire models available at up to 60% off. And as I've told you before, Jensen USA is the place where you're going to find the best selection, the best prices, and the best customer service. Head on over to jensenusa.com/thefredcast, or just go to thefredcast.com and click the Jensen USA link on the right-hand side of the page. And if you haven't tried Jensen USA yet, when you're looking for your new cyclocross tires, or you're looking for something for your trainer or a trainer itself, or just for some great winter cycling gear, head on over to JensenUSA.com. The first time you try them out, I guarantee will not be your last. So it's JensenUSA.com/thefredcast, or go to thefredcast.com and click the Jensen USA link. Thank you so much for supporting our sponsor, Jensen USA, and we thank Jensen USA so much for supporting the Fredcast. And now, let's get to the news. Actually, before we do that, one quick word, a personal word for me. We're coming up on the 5th anniversary of the Fredcast in December. I'm really excited about that. And ever since the first year of the Fredcast, I've been honored to have been nominated for some awards and to have won some awards. And one of the awards that I've been nominated for year after year is a podcast award. And it's something I would very much like to win. Well, nominations are open right now for the 2010 Podcast Awards at podcastawards.com. And those will stay open until November the 21st. I would very much appreciate your nomination in the sports category. And then in early December, the actual voting for the awards will take place. I'll let you know about that. But if you're feeling so inclined, please go to www.podcastawards.com. Vote for the Fredcast in the sports category. And I thank you so much for your support. Topping the news this week is a controversial story out of Vail, Colorado. It seems that a New York doctor, Stephen Milo, was vacationing in Vail, Colorado in July when he was hit from behind by Martin Joel Erzinger with his 2010 black Mercedes sedan. Not only was he hit, but it was a hit and run. The doctor was left for dead, and the guy driving the Mercedes drove all the way into town, stopped off in a Pizza Hut parking lot, and called the Mercedes road assistance service to report the damage to his car, but conveniently forgot to call law enforcement. He was arrested later and should have been charged with a crime. However, Eagle County District Attorney Mark Hurlburt has decided not to charge 52-year-old Martin Erzinger with a felony. And he said the reason for this is because Erzinger, who is a fund manager if he were convicted of a felony, would lose the ability to support his family and also his clients. Now, consider the fact that not only did he hit Dr. Milo, who's 34 years old, not only did he leave him for dead, but Dr. Milo suffered spinal cord injuries, bleeding from his brain, and damage to his knee and scapula. According to court documents, over the past 6 weeks, he has suffered disabling spinal headaches, and he faces multiple surgeries for a herniated disc and plastic surgery to fix the scars he suffered in the accident. Now, Dr. Milo is involved in liver transplant surgery, and according to his attorney, quote, he will have lifetime pain. His ability to deal with the physical challenges of his profession has been seriously jeopardized. Erzinger manages a fund of more than $1 billion. That's billion with a B, folks. And if he is charged with a felony, he would have to disclose that publicly within 30 days. And yes, you can imagine that that would have an effect on his ability to earn money. However, Dr. Milo, in a letter to the district attorney, Mark Hurlburt, in the case, says that, quote, the case has always been about responsibility, not money. Mr. Erzinger struck me, fled, and left me for dead on the highway. Neither his financial prominence nor my financial situation should be factors in your prosecution of this case. For his part, District Attorney Hurlburt said on Thursday that this case is, in part, about money, saying, quote, the money has never been a priority for them. It is for us. Justice in this case includes restitution and the ability to pay it. He continues by saying, felony convictions have some pretty serious job implications for someone in Mr. Erzinger's profession, and that entered into it. When you're talking about restitution, you don't want to take away his ability to pay. We have talked with Mr. Milo's attorney, and we heard their objections, but ultimately, it's our call. And you know what? That's absolutely true. Ultimately, it is the district attorney's call as to whether or not he or she is going to prosecute an individual case. James Wong from Cycling News and many others, both within and without the bicycle industry, have taken offense to the way that Mr. Hurlburt has framed this case. Yes, we do want to see the defendant in the case pay restitution to Dr. Milo. There's no doubt about that. But I'm betting that somebody who manages a fund of over $1 billion in assets probably has some money in the bank and is probably able to pay that restitution. But justice isn't only about restitution. Justice is about punishment. Justice is about making sure that someone who does something intentional, like fleeing the scene of an accident where it's pretty clear that you've hit a human being, despite the fact that that person may have been on a bicycle, and leaving them for dead, well, at least where I come from, punishment is part of justice. And so James Wong from Cycling News brought this up, and thankfully it is now getting the international attention that it so deserves. Now, later in the show, I'm going to talk to you about the fact that the Quiznos Pro Challenge, the modern version of what was once the Tour of Colorado, is going to be stopping in Vail, Colorado. Our friend Fritz from Cyclicious suggests, and there is a link in the show notes for this, that perhaps while he is going to the Quiznos Pro Challenge next summer, perhaps we should avoid Vail, Colorado. Also, James Wong has started a petition on change.org. There is a link in the show notes to where you can sign the petition, as I did. And he's also started a Facebook group called We're People on Bikes, Not Lifeless Objects or Obstacles in Your Way. So I'll put links to those in the show notes as well so that you can sign the petition and join the Facebook group. Now, I don't claim to be an attorney. I don't claim to be a student of the judicial system in Colorado or in Vail in particular. However, I have read several stories on the internet where people have complained about this district attorney before. As an example, you may recall the instance where two women last year were charged with felony criminal impersonation when one woman could not participate in the Leadville Trail 100 and gave her registration to another. Now, admittedly, in that case, the one who did end up racing took second place in her category, even though she's actually younger than the category in which the older woman had originally registered. Nevertheless, a felony charge as a result of that seemed, well, a bit harsh. Or how about the fact that someone who snowboarded drunk down the slopes of Vail and ran over an 8-year-old in a hit and run got a serious felony charge dropped to a lesser crime? Or someone who had been charged with attempted murder and got that pled down to a misdemeanor with no jail time? Or someone who pulled a woman by her hair across a barroom floor, tearing half of it out while screaming extremely derogatory words at her, got off with a misdemeanor and 60 days of work release. Now, I don't know the background of those individual cases. I only know this case of this doctor in a hit and run, and it seems to me that D.A. Hurlburt has a lot of splaining to do. Many of you know that last Tuesday was Election Day here in the United States, and that this was a particularly interesting election in that there seems to be a very strong tide turning in the United States against the Democratic Party and toward the Republican Party as a result of the economy here in the States. And as a result of that, a number of Democratic congresspeople were swept out of Congress and replaced by Republicans as a part of this backlash. And one of those was a very, very good friend of the cycling community, somebody that Andy Clark, the president of the League of American Bicyclists, called a true champion of bicyclists' issues, Representative James Oberstar of Minnesota. He lost his reelection campaign and will no longer be in Congress come January. According to a blog post by Andy Clark, the president of the League of American Cyclists, he said that he was depressed, and he said, quote, "Whichever way you spin it, bicyclists and the bicycling movement have lost a friend in Congress." Now, for those of you who don't know, Oberstar was the chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and was one of the most powerful Democrats in Congress and led the cycling advocacy movement within Congress. He helped bring federal funding to a lot of cycling initiatives, including something you've probably heard about before, Safe Routes to Schools, and also made sure that cyclists were included in transportation bills and transportation planning and making sure that the infrastructure in this country was appropriate for cyclists. James Oberstar will be missed in Congress, but that means that Earl Blumenauer of Oregon will now probably be the most prominent cycling advocate in Congress, and so we hope that he will continue to carry the flag that James Oberstar will soon lay down. Every now and again here on the Fredcast, we talk about an event that occurs on the last Friday of every month called Critical Mass. There are those in the Critical Mass movement who would tell you that Critical Mass is simply a celebration of cycling, a celebration of the fact that bikes are allowed to be on the roadways and that they are legal vehicles to the roads as automobiles. Meanwhile, there are plenty of other people who have disdain for Critical Mass, who feel that it's an anarchistic demonstration and that it gives all cyclists a bad name. Well, no matter which side of Critical Mass you come down on, I have a feeling that you're going to have some problems with this story. It appears that in Long Beach, California on Friday, police shut down the Critical Mass ride. There were about 85 bicyclists included, and they seized more than 20 bicycles for various offenses, including riding unlicensed bikes. Also stopped the ride because they said that the organizers did not have the necessary permit. And I think that if that was their main reason for stopping the cyclists, that would be enough. And you and I probably wouldn't have an issue with the story. But the problem with this bike registration, in my mind, is very, very sticky, because apparently to lawfully ride a bike on the streets of the city of Long Beach, cyclists have to register their bikes with the city and have it inspected by the fire department. Personally, I've ridden my bike on the streets of Long Beach time after time. I've never had my bike inspected by the fire department or had it registered and paid the $3 fee. So I guess that that makes me a scofflaw as well. Personally, I think that this is being used as an excuse by a city who simply does not want to deal with critical mass anymore. The police chief of the city of Long Beach, Chief Jim McDonald, said, quote, "We take bicycle safety seriously in Long Beach and will not stand by idly while any person or group acts with blatant disregard for the safety of the residents of our community." By the way, I checked, in case you're wondering, bike licenses are issued on Saturdays and Sundays only between the hours of 9 a.m. and noon at most fire stations in Long Beach. When you get there, not only will you pay your $3 fee, but you better hope the firefighters are not out on a call, because if they are, either you'll be waiting or you're going to be out of luck for the day. So not a whole lot of opportunity. Imagine how many bikes there are in Long Beach, or how many cyclists in Southern California might ride through Long Beach to have 6 possible hours a week and to have to pay the $3 fee. I don't know of any other city that makes that requirement. As you can imagine, this became a big story in Southern California, indeed around the country. And as a result, the city of Long Beach issued a press release after the event to try to mitigate the damage as a result of the stoppage of the critical mass and the impounding of the bicycles. The press release reads in part, "As a bike-friendly city, bicycle safety is of utmost importance to Long Beach. On Friday, October 29th, 2010, Long Beach Police issued over 70 citations to critical mass cyclists who disobeyed the rules of the road. Long Beach welcomes and supports bike organizations that promote bike awareness and ride our streets. However, as a bike-friendly city," bike-friendly city is in all caps, by the way, "we take bicycle safety seriously, and Long Beach must ensure our laws are followed to protect our community and our cyclists. Cyclists that do not follow the rules of the road create motorist animosity towards cyclists, which directly conflicts with Long Beach's goal of being America's most bike-friendly city. Riding responsibly is the duty of every cyclist, just as we expect every motorist to respect our cyclists." The press release then outlines all of the great things that Long Beach has admittedly done to make it such a bike-friendly community. And then it says, "Long Beach thanks all of our cyclists who are riding safely and respectfully and helping Long Beach become America's most bike-friendly city." It then recaps the events of Friday, talking about the number of citations it issued to cyclists who, quote, "disobeyed the rules of the road, including running stop signs. The group was stopped in the area of Anaheim Road and Palo Verde Avenue and was cited for violating rules of the road as well as safety issues. In the case of this event, the city's Special Events Bureau and Long Beach Police Department attempted to work with the organizers in advance of the event. City staff explained what would be required to safely conduct the event, but critical mass," in italics by the way, "chose not to apply for a city permit. The group was informed by the police department that the city would not allow violations of city safety laws. 21 bikes were impounded that night for not having required safety equipment," including bikes without brakes. And then they gave appointments, they gave a phone number so that people could make appointments to pick up their bikes. As you can imagine, the cyclists involved in the critical mass event are planning to respond to the Long Beach City and the Long Beach Police Department to what they consider to have been an insult to them and their rights. There is a city council meeting in Long Beach on November the 9th, and I have a feeling many of those who were at critical mass and perhaps more of their supporters will be at that meeting as well. Well, unfortunately, I have another product recall to tell you about, this one for 2010 model year EC90 Easton seat posts. These were sold by Turner Suspension Bikes, Ibis Cycles, and Security Bicycle Accessory Retailers nationwide from April 2010 through August 2010 for between $150 and $200. There's about 200 of these out in circulation, and at least when I looked at the recall PDF that was on Easton's website, there are some EC90s that have been recalled and some that have not. If you're unsure, of course, stop riding your bike right away, but go to the Easton website. Of course, there's links in the show notes to where you can find really great pictures on how to identify whether your seat post is affected by the recall or whether it is not. Again, if you're unsure, take it to your local dealer and have them check it out. Now, the problem here is that the carbon top clamp of the seat post can crack. And of course, you know what that means. You could, your seat could fall off and you could have a serious fall hazard, maybe an impalement hazard as well. As of right now, they've had no reports of incidents or injuries, but they always recommend that you stop riding your bike immediately, contact an authorized Easton Sports dealer for a free replacement top seat clamp. Once again, there are links in the show notes to where you can find information from the Consumer Product Safety Commission and also to that PDF on the Easton website. Show notes are at www.thefredcast.com, and this is show number 170. Well, we're coming right into cold and flu season, and our friends at BikeBiz pointed us to an article in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, specifically in their November 1st online edition, that repeats the often heard slogan that there is no cure for the common cold, but that what will help you get better faster is regular exercise. According to the study, people who exercise regularly have fewer and milder colds. That's great news. So for those of you, you know, your friends seem to be getting colds and flus all the time, and you always wonder, gee, I'm never getting sick. Now you know why. In doing this study, the researchers gathered data on more than 1,000 men and women from ages 18 to 85. And they tracked them over 12 weeks in the fall and winter of 2008. They tracked the number of upper respiratory tract infections that the people in the study suffered, and then they looked at who among those were regular exercisers and who were not. According to the researchers, the frequency of colds among those who exercised for 5 or more days a week was up to 46% less than those who exercised 1 or fewer days per week. In addition, the number of days that people were suffering from cold symptoms was 41% lower among those who were physically active as compared to those who were not. The lead researcher for this study was Dr. David C. Neiman, the director of the Human Performance Lab at Appalachian State University in North Carolina. He was asked to explain why, in his opinion, it might be that those of us who are physically active seem to get sick less, and the severity of those illnesses when we get them is also less severe. And he said that it's possible that exercise activates the immune system at a higher rate and causes immune cells to attack viruses. He says exercise gets those cells circulating around the body. They engage the enemy and deal with them. Any aerobic exercise should give you these immune benefits. But since we're cyclists and our aerobic exercise of choice is cycling, go right ahead and ride as often as you can. And if anybody calls you crazy or tells you that you're riding too much, guess who's going to be able to get up and around this fall and winter? And guess who isn't? For those of you looking to rendezvous with some other cyclists for weekly or occasional group rides, the performance apparel company Rafa recently announced the arrival in the iTunes App Store of the Rafa Rendezvous application. According to the description, it was developed for road cyclists and designed to make meeting up for group rides easier. You can invite other riders and observe them in real time making progress to the rendezvous point on a map. A little Big Brother-ish for me. According to the description, no more hanging around for friends, failed phone calls, SMS annoyances, or scrolling hundreds of emails. Rafa Rendezvous makes meeting for quick rides quick and easy, giving you more time on the bike. Now, I gave the app a quick try that found one ride here in Park City, none in Salt Lake. I put in Los Angeles and it didn't give me any rides, only three in San Francisco. I think it's a really good idea and something that I'm kind of spreading the word about because I'd like to see more people using it. It is sometimes difficult, especially if you are visiting someplace on vacation or for business, or if you're new to a city, it's sometimes difficult to find group rides if that's something that you're interested in doing. And so an application like this might be very helpful to help you find some rides. I suppose one drawback, at least in my opinion, is, you know, I have so many usernames and passwords. I really don't understand why Rafa requires you to create a new user account on their website just to use the application. I'm going to be curious to see whether or not they're going to start spamming my email box. I'm hoping not, but let's all start using the application a little bit more and see if we can't get it better populated with more group rides around the country, indeed around the world. I did put links in the show notes to where you can find the Rafa Rendezvous iPhone app. It's in the iTunes App Store and it is free. For the last couple of years here on the Fredcast, we've talked a lot about urban bike share programs. These programs where you can borrow a bike for a short period of time for very little money. Getting people out of their cars and onto bikes is always a good thing. Well, the University of California at Los Angeles, also known as UCLA, now has a great program for their students where they can rent a Felt Cafe Hybrid City Cruiser, an 8-speed bike, for just $35 per academic quarter. Similar bike, brand new, would cost $550 for a college student. This is a really great opportunity. The opportunity comes thanks to the UCLA Bike Library that has 50 of these Felt bikes on hand. As of last week, only 9 of them had been spoken for. And the UCLA Bike Library came about as a result of a student vote that raised the tuition $4 per student, and that $4 going to fund student-initiated sustainability projects like the UCLA Bike Library. These bikes are pretty cool, by the way. They come with front and rear fenders, front and rear lights, a rear rack, and a cup holder. More information can be found in the show notes. There's a link to the UCLA Bike Library and also to a great blog post from the UCLA Transportation Commuter blog. So there you go. Go Bruins. Well, we're going to stop right here before we get to the professional cycling news. And I want to tell you about a great deal from our friends over at Epic Planet. We've talked about them here on the show before. They are the producers of those great indoor cycling DVDs called Epic Rides. And I've reviewed them here on the show and I've told you that I think that the camera work and the quality is just stunning. And I've just finished getting my indoor cycling room ready for the season, since the snow is going to start flying tomorrow, as a matter of fact. And I've got my Epic Rides DVDs all lined up in order so that I will not get bored on my trainer this year. Well, our good friends over at Epic Planet have a great deal for Fredcast listeners right now. You may remember a couple of months ago, I told you that they came out with a couple of new releases from a trip to Texas, one from Austin, Texas, and one from the Texas Hill Country, Epic Austin and Epic Texas Hill Country. And now, if you go to www.thefredcast.com and click on the Epic Rides link on the right-hand side of the page, or just go to epicplanet.tv/Fredcast, you'll be able to take advantage of the Fredcast Texas bundle, where if you buy Epic Austin and Epic Texas Hill Country, you will get both DVDs or digital downloads for just $39.95, and that is a saving of $20 over the individual purchase price. This is a great deal. It's available for a limited time only, in the month of November for Fredcast listeners. So make sure you take advantage now. Go to epicplanet.tv/Fredcast for the Fredcast Texas Bundle. Thank you so much for supporting Epic Planet, and we thank Epic Planet for supporting the Fredcast. Well, moving on to professional cycling news, I do have some results. This from the Tour of the Southland in New Zealand, a 9-stage race won by Hayden Ralston from the Calder Stewart Bike New Zealand national team in 20 hours, 58 minutes, and 23 seconds. Second place going to Jack Bauer, not the special agent from TV, from the Share the Road team, 2 seconds behind Ralston. Third to Jeremy Yates, also from Share the Road, 1 minute 34 seconds back. Now, why am I even mentioning this? Well, it's because of who came in fourth place at the Tour of Southland, and that was none other than Floyd Landis, 3 minutes 12 seconds back of Hayden Ralston, and Landis taking a lot of the spotlight away from Ralston's victory simply by being there and racing and performing as well as he did. Now, there was additional news in the Floyd Landis universe last week when a judge in France decided that Floyd Landis and his coach, Arnie Baker, will stand trial in that hacking case that we talked about a couple of months ago, where Floyd and Arnie were accused of hacking into a French doping lab. Specifically, Floyd Landis is going to be tried for receiving in fraudulent intrusion, and Arnie Baker is going to be tried for complicity and receiving in the fraudulent intrusion into an automated treatment system. When police in New Zealand were asked about a potential arrest warrant, they said that they were unaware of any such warrant. Speaking of dopers, Pat McQuaid, the president of the International Cycling Union, or the UCI, was recently quoted by the Associated Press as saying that the 2-year suspensions that are commonly given out to those convicted of doping in cycling are simply not long enough. He is now advocating for 4-year bans. McQuaid quoted as saying, quote, "I'm increasingly going for 4 years because 2 years is very quick. An athlete returns to the peloton very quick. I think it's unfair to the clean athletes that guys who have cheated in premeditated cheating can come back so quickly." Meanwhile, on the case of Alberto Contador, Pat McQuaid was asked whether or not the UCI was dragging its heels, something many in cycling circles, no pun intended, have accused the UCI of doing. McQuaid said, quote, "We're working with WADA. Our scientific people and their scientific people are working together to try to determine how the clenbuterol got into Contador's system. We're waiting for WADA to come back to us with a report. As soon as we get that, we'll take decisions within hours." He then went on to say, "I think that point might be fast approaching." Meanwhile, the Spanish Cycling Federation says Alberto Contador is cleared to ride. The Spanish Cycling Federation was quoted as saying, "We do not have official notification from the International Cycling Union, and so, to this day, the rider's license is in effect and he can compete." That from Juan Carlos Castaño, president of the Spanish Cycling Federation. He said, "The UCI has not yet notified us that we should suspend his license, so there would be no legal impediment to his racing. We will ask the UCI to clarify, to tell us how we should act, and whether he is suspended." So for all intents and purposes, Spanish Cycling Federation says Contador is still good to go. In other news surrounding a Spanish cyclist and doping, Alejandro Valverde appealed his suspension before the Court of Arbitration for Sport and recently lost that appeal. Valverde was suspended in sort of a strange twist of circumstances. You recall that he was implicated in the Operation Puerto scandal in Spain, but that Spanish prosecutors and judicial officials stymied efforts to go after riders who had been implicated in that case. Nevertheless, the Italian Olympic Committee used DNA evidence from Operation Puerto that had been linked to Valverde and matched it against blood bags that were taken during the 2008 Tour de France when the riders had a rest day. They put those two things together, decided that Valverde was a doper, and banned him from Italy. Then the UCI and the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, were asked to extend that ban worldwide, and they did so, banning Valverde until January of 2012, to be specific. Valverde appealed the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and the Court of Arbitration for Sport has now upheld the ban against Alejandro Valverde. However, according to news reports, his appeal process may not be over. A lot of times people think of the Court of Arbitration for Sport as the court of last resort for athletes. However, in this case, Alejandro Valverde's advisors said last spring that any decision by the Court of Arbitration for Sport might be appealed at the European Court of Human Rights, so the Valverde case may live on. An ocean away in Los Angeles, a federal investigation continues against Lance Armstrong. Numerous people have already testified before the grand jury there, including Alan Lim and Stephen McElvain, a longtime friend of Lance Armstrong. Recently, Yaroslav Popovich, Lance Armstrong's teammate for many years, was compelled by subpoena to appear before the grand jury, and he did so last week. According to his attorney, Ken Miller, quote, they forced him to be there. They served him in Austin, Texas, and Popovich was in Austin for the Livestrong ride. They served him in Austin, Texas, and made him appear 2 weeks later in Los Angeles when he was only supposed to be in the States for 4 days. Popovich had only planned to be in the States for that short period of time and then had vacation plans. Those vacation plans had to be postponed so that he could go to Los Angeles for the testimony. According to Popovich's attorney, Ken Miller, Popo had no idea what it was that they were investigating, but because of the subpoena, he went and he did testify. As you may know, grand juries meet in closed session, and federal authorities so far have refused to talk about what results, if any, have come from their investigation so far. Concluding the doping news for this week comes word from WADA and the UCI that nighttime doping controls may be in the future for Tour de France cyclists. At last year's Tour de France, the 2010 Tour de France, there was a team of 6 independent observers who were there to watch the anti-doping measures and evaluate their effectiveness. They found that the anti-doping measures were of, quote, good quality, and that there were very few, quote, anti-doping programs delivered by international federations that come close to matching that of the UCI. In other words, cycling is doing a pretty good job of watching its athletes. However, they did say that while they weren't able to detect any big issues with the UCI and WADA's programs, they felt that they might need to make some tweaks to what they're doing. And in case you're not familiar, obviously, there are anti-doping controls at the end of every stage. Certain riders who win stages or who are leading automatically are subjected to those anti-doping controls, and then others are randomly chosen for anti-doping controls as well. Outside of competition, investigators can show up at riders' houses unannounced and request samples as a way of randomly checking upon riders with these surprise inspections. Well, this team of independent observers is now suggesting that they get even tougher during major international competitions, including testing riders in the middle of the night. They said that the increased anti-doping measures should include, quote, increasing the number of anti-doping tests and testing in less acceptable hours with a greater chance of detecting substances and or methods with short detection windows and significantly limiting the use of a random draw. In other words, if someone is microdoping or someone is using doping products whose half-lives are too short to be detected the next day, they feel that nighttime controls might be better. Now, one of the reasons that they suggested this, and this is all cloak and dagger stuff, besides observing anti-doping controls, the team of independent observers was also observing the teams. And they would observe the teams, sounds like almost 24 hours a day, in sort of trench coats and lurking in dark alleys, because they said, quote, on two occasions, the independent observer team could clearly see two persons watching the parking from their room windows, half hidden behind the curtain, as well as a team member seated in front of the hotel, who immediately used his mobile phone when he saw the team. There could have been an innocent explanation for this, but it was evident that for unannounced testing to be effective, the need for a speedy and discreet entry to the hotel was of paramount importance due to the potential for samples to be manipulated over a short space of time. As you can imagine, a lot of writers have already come out and poo-pooed this idea, saying that they think that they have enough intrusions into their lives and that they need their sleep during competition. But those people who are strict anti-doping individuals, they think that this is a great idea. And rounding out our pro cycling news in general tonight, I'm going to give you a quick lightning round of information from around the world of professional cycling. Last week, the Quiznos Pro Challenge announced their 2011 route. It is a tough race with some very difficult climbs and some very high elevation. I think this is going to be a great spectator event. It begins August the 22nd with a prologue time trial in Colorado Springs. Stage 2 goes from Salida to Crested Butte with a mountaintop finish. Stage 3 goes from Gunnison to Aspen, and it is a mountain stage. Stage 4 is a time trial in Vail, and this is a former stage from the Coors Classic, and also, by the way, that particular stage that we talked about earlier, where those folks, including the folks over at Cyclicious, are recommending a boycott of this particular stage as a result of what's going on in Vail. Stage 5 on August 26th is from Avon to Steamboat Springs. Stage 6 on August 27th is from Steamboat to Breckenridge. And Stage 7, the final stage, goes from Golden, Colorado, down to Denver. Speaking of routes, and I know we just talked about the 2011 Tour de France route on the last show, the organizers of the Tour de France, the Amaury Sports Organization, or ASO, announced last week that the 2012 edition of the Tour de France will begin in the Belgian city of Liège. You'll recall that this year's Tour de France began in Rotterdam, and that the 2007 Tour de France began in London. So starting the French race in another nation is totally understandable, and I think Liège will be a great spot to start the tour. Liège is the start and finish of the famous classic every year, Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And while we're talking about the Tour de France, the issue of the infamous black jersey incident from the final stage of this year's Tour de France, when Team Radio Shack wore their non-standard black jerseys with the number 28 on them to support the Livestrong Foundation, and then got in trouble with the organizers for breaking the rules and wearing a non-standard jersey. Well, finally, a decision has come down as to what the punishment will be. The UCI fined Lance Armstrong and each of his teammates $2,540 for wearing those non-standard black jerseys. And team director Johan Brunel was fined $10,167 and suspended for 2 months next season, not only for the incident with the black jerseys, but also for insulting race officials in a tweet that we've talked about previously on this show. The suspension is in February and March, and that means that Brunel will be with Lance Armstrong in his final international cycling event at the Tour Down Under in January. One more disciplinary decision as a result of the Tour de France. Do you remember when Carlos Barreto attacked Rui Costa after one of the stages. I think it was the sixth stage of this year's Tour de France. Remember when that happened? It was a great YouTube video. Actually, there were several of them from different angles. Well, as a result of that melee, Carlos Barreto drew a 2-month suspension for, quote, damaging cycling's image, unquote, and he will serve that in January and February. And Barreto, who was on Quickstep in 2010, will be on Rabobank in 2011. Okay, two pieces of team news for you, and then we will be done with our pro cycling segment for the evening. First of all, the as yet to be named Luxembourg Pro team from Frank and Andy Schleck has now added Stuart O'Grady as a team member, and there are rumors that Fabian Cancellara will be next. There's not a doubt in my mind that this is going to be the team to beat next year. Look who's on it already. I mean, whether Cancellara comes or not, although I expect he will, Frank Schleck, Andy Schleck, Daniela Bonatti, Jens Voigt, Fabian Wegman, Linus Gerdemann, Jakob Fuglsang, and Stuart O'Grady, among others. This is going to be an incredible team in the coming years. According to Andy Schleck, he and his brother Frank have signed a 4-year agreement with this new team, and that it was started by an entrepreneur. He said that it was put together in a very similar way to the way that High Road and Slipstream were put together a few years ago. I suspect that we will be hearing the name of the title sponsor very, very soon. Heard a rumor the other day that it was actually a Luxembourg fast food chain that was going to be the title sponsor, but that remains to be confirmed. We should find out very, very soon. And finally, the Schleck's former team, Team Saxo Bank, has found itself in a bit of a pickle. Remember, they signed Alberto Contador, taking him from Astana at the end of the season, hoping that he was going to be the leader of their team in 2011 and beyond. With Alberto Contador's looming troubles with the UCI and the World Anti-Doping Agency, rumors began to swirl that Bjarne Riis needed to look for a new team leader. There were lots of reports that indicated that Michael Rasmussen would be signed by Team Saxo Bank to be the new leader of the team. However, today, Bjarne Riis announced, and this was part of his promotional tour for his new autobiography, simply called Riis, covering his career, his 1996 Tour de France win, and his admitted use of EPO. And as part of that, he was quoted as saying, quote, "I've seen the newspaper reports and rumors that I will announce Michael as the new rider. It should end quickly. I hardly have contact with him. There is no agreement, and I will not hire Michael Rasmussen for Team Saxo Bank SunGard." That's pretty definitive. I think that should put all of the rumors to rest. Well, moving away from professional cycling, I wanted to sort of read you an email that I got from listener Scott that definitely fits in with the news and something that was a positive story that I wanted to share with you. He said, "I just wanted to drop you a note about an interesting news item that my local club was involved in. I think it's an example of how cycling clubs can make a direct difference in how their community views and appreciates cyclists. I belong to the Ann Arbor Bicycle Touring Society in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We recently got news that the County Road Commission was going to repave a portion of road that is a very popular route for cyclists and runners. The federal funds that were going to be used, however, were withdrawn once the repairs were deemed too costly. This decision was so disappointing to local cyclists and pedestrians that we launched a grassroots effort, a fundraising campaign, where the Ann Arbor Bicycle Touring Society members, along with Ann Arbor Velo Club members and others, started sending in private funds to pay for the road improvements. The original goal, $30,000. The amount has surpassed $45,000. Because of the amount raised, the Parks and Recreation Department and the County Road Commission decided to both match the donations, resulting in a total budget of $185,000 to fix the road. In fact, so much money was raised that additional sections of the road are going to be improved beyond the original plan. Included in this will be new bike lanes and road widening. This is a shining example that can be held up for drivers who think that fuel tax is somehow paying for the roads. You hear that, Carlton Reed? There are plans to erect a roadside sign thanking the cycling community for the road improvements. I can't wait to ride past it. Well, Scott, thank you so much for sharing that story. And by the way, Scott provided a number of links to news articles, and I'll put those in the show notes. But I didn't see any reason to summarize the articles or give you my opinion. I just wanted to read Scott's email because he's absolutely right. It is a shining example of what can be done when we all work together toward a common goal. So kudos to the Ann Arbor Bicycle Touring Society, to the Ann Arbor Velo Club, to the Parks and Recreation Department and the County Road Commission out there in Ann Arbor. Great job. Congratulations to all of you for taking on an important challenge. And finally tonight, we started with, well, what I think is a stupid decision by a district attorney. Let's end tonight with what I think is a stupid decision by a judge in Manhattan, in New York City. Because this judge decided that a little girl who was involved in an accident when she was riding a bike at the age of 4 years old is old enough to be sued. Okay, so get this. Earlier this month, a Manhattan judge refused to toss out negligence claims against Juliet Brightman. She, her mother, and others are being sued by the estate of a woman who said she was severely hurt when hit by bicycles that Juliet and a boy were racing down a sidewalk in April of 2009. The judge decided that there is no evidence that a child of that age couldn't appreciate, quote, the danger of riding a bicycle into an elderly woman. Now, the elderly woman who was involved in the crash did fall down and did suffer a hip fracture that required surgery. So there's no doubt that her injuries were serious. She died a few months later of totally unrelated causes, and it's her estate that is suing the young girl and her parents. Now, in legal papers, the attorney said that, quote, courts have held that an infant under the age of four is conclusively presumed to be incapable of negligence. However, the judge in this case decided that he would not stretch that rule to cover children over the age of four. However, in this instance, the little girl was riding her bike with training wheels under the supervision of her parents. And while this particular case did not focus on whether or not the little girl was liable, it only focused on whether or not she could be sued. Personally, I think it's a stupid decision. Suing a four-year-old for what? What kind of assets are you going to get from the four-year-old? Her tricycle? Her dolly collection? Ladies and gentlemen, I submit that tonight's show, the beginning and the end, show us that when it comes to justice, not only is justice blind, but sometimes it acts like a child. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Fredcast. Before we go, I do want to thank our sponsors, Jensen USA. Don't forget, Jensen USA has the best selection, best prices, and best customer service. Go to jensenusa.com/thefredcast and see what a difference it makes buying from Jensen USA. I also want to thank Epic Planet. Go to epicplanet.tv/fredcast where you can take advantage of the Fredcast Texas Bundle. Get two great DVDs and save $20 at the same time. And finally, I want to thank all of you for your donations. Just by going to thefredcast.com and clicking the donation link, it keeps the Fredcast going, and we greatly appreciate it. Don't forget to keep in touch with Fredcast between shows. Best way to know what's going on with the Fredcast is through social media, of course. On Twitter, we are simply Fredcast. And on Facebook, it's facebook.com/Fredcast. Of course, you can go to our website for show notes and other links at www.thefredcast.com or send us an email to thefredcast@gmail.com or use the Fredcast listener hotline at area code 661-513-FRED. That's 661-513-4255. 3733. Now it's time for PodSafe Cycling Music. This week's PodSafe Cycling Music was chosen specifically for the Fredcast by the Cadence Revolution, your weekly podcast of PodSafe music that's perfect for your indoor cycling, available at www.cadencerevolution.com. And by the way, if you're a Cadence Revolution listener, as I am, and if you are so inclined to go and nominate someone for a podcast award, I would strongly recommend nominating Cadence Revolution in the PodSafe music category. I did that earlier today and hope that you will too. And I know that everyone over at Cadence Revolution would appreciate that. Well, tonight's music, appropriately titled Little Brown-Haired Girls, considering that last news story, it comes to us from Frankie Rose and the Outs. And there are links in the show notes to Cadence Revolution and to where you can find the song and the artist on iTunes. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Fredcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for staying subscribed, and thank you for telling your friends about the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. I greatly appreciate it. This is David Bernstein, your host of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. We'll be back very shortly with another episode of the Fredcast, but between this show and the next, enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride.